Well, good afternoon, everybody. Stan Turner with you here on a bright, sunny day. The temperatures are tolerable. Things are looking good. Let's see. Kyle, I'm trying to figure out here, about 21 degrees? Is that
what
the man said?
Yeah, that's what I'm reading right here.
Okay, good. Stan Turner with you here, if I didn't say so, and Kyle, our wonderful board op producer and engineer. Thank you so much, Kyle. Well, you know, on the way down here this morning to Stillwater, I saw a man jogging, nothing too terribly unusual, but he had shorts on. Is that pushing it just a bit?
I think a little bit right now. Yeah.
Still a lot of ice on the sidewalks. He almost did what we call a three-pointer, you know, down, slip, boom on your posterior and your two heels. That's a three-pointer. He didn't quite go down, but he came close. But so people are kind of pushing it. I don't blame them. I feel the same way. We want to start doing spring with the hope of summer to come. Dare we imagine that? I don't know. Well, folks, again, thank you for being with us. One reminder here that, spring is maybe closer than we think. Ha-ha, daylight saving time arrives this weekend. Most Americans will be setting their clocks, including us, 60 minutes forward. Push it ahead tonight before heading to bed. Daylight saving time officially starts tomorrow morning, 2 a.m. So, Kyle, make sure you do that, okay? Now, you may lose an hour of sleep, but daylight saving time promises an extra hour, yay, of evening light for many months to come. Daylight saving time will go off on November 2nd. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it, huh?
Yeah, it does sound pretty good.
Now, for those of you listening to us right now in Hawaii or Arizona, people do stream. They stream us. If you're in Hawaii, Arizona, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, American Samoa, Guam, and the Northern Marianas, you do not have to push your clock ahead because those places do not observe daylight saving time. So, again, before you retire tonight or early tomorrow morning, push the clock ahead 1 hour and you won't be, what would you be? You'd be late if you didn't do that, wouldn't you?
You'd be late.
You'd be late. Thank you. That's the voice of David Schultz there, an authoritative, wonderful guy, and we're going to get to it right now. When I covered the legislature for KSDP TV Channel 5 News, some people used to ask me, I used to get this quite a bit, isn't that boring, like the worst beat a reporter could have, the legislature? Whoa. My quick and emphatic reply was, no, no way. Everything our lawmakers do during their lawmaking session affects us, impacts us all. Same goes for what lawmakers do in Congress. Just propose a law, say, to require helmets for motorcycle riders, and wow, presto, you have people's attention and they show up in droves at the Capitol to be seen and heard, as they should. Many of the issues before lawmakers are less attention-getting, but nonetheless important. By the way, there's no helmet law before the legislature this time around, so don't panic. You have likely noticed that both the Minnesota legislature and Congress are in session right now, so high time for us to see what our esteemed lawgivers are up to. And no one is better equipped to navigate through all the debate, the hard shout, the behind-the-scenes maneuvering, the political posturing, than Hamline University's David Schultz. Let's hear it for David. David, give out a shout for yourself.
Okay? I'll give a shout to myself and say thank you. That's one heck of an introduction you did there.
I'm not even done yet.
All right.
David is professor of just about everything that has to do with government, politics, and the law. Would that cover it, David?
That's pretty accurate.
All right. Well, David is a regular on this show. We're going to drop pretenses and titles. I could call you professor, but I'm not. I'm going to call you David.
That's perfect.
David's a regular on this program. We are delighted to have him back, of course. This, last time I checked, is an election year for many government officials, and that always adds an extra dimension or two or ten to the government debate. Lots of hot button issues are on the docket, David. So let's start. Let's start here with the Minnesota legislature. Okay,
sure.
Let's do it. They are in session. They've been there now for a few days, and some of the big issues that we're going to talk about have already bubbled up and are being debated. But first, let's focus on a guy named Mark Dayton.
Yes,
governor of the state of Minnesota. He is up for re-election this year, is he not?
He's up for re-election,
yes.
And he looks pretty good shape right now. The last public opinion polls, if polls can be believed, he's got an approval rating of over 50%. And just actually, I got to do a quick funny point here. Yep. I know you have Gail Rosenblum on the show once in a while.
Yes, do.
And I did an interview with her and a piece that came out last week in the Star Tribune. Mm-hmm. And we pointed out and said that only in politics, if only half the people hate you, are you considered a success. Mark Dayton has an approval rating above 50%. He's got several million dollars in the bank. Yep. No clear Republican challenger. He looks pretty good into this legislature. legislative session, and more importantly, looks good into the election in 2014. So he wants to use this session as a way of sort of cementing his chances for a second term.
All right. Now, I've had a few people, they are detractors of Mark Dayton as governor, say, how can these numbers be that high for him? That terrible Minsure rollout, a massive screw-up, you know, the Minnesota's online health insurance marketplace, that went badly. He pushed same-sex marriage. A lot of people still don't like that, even though it's law in this state. The stadium, public financing to help Ziggy Wilf. Some people call it Ziggy Fair, to get the Viking stadium up and running. These people say, why no blowback against Dayton on these things and other things? How can his numbers be that high?
Well, that's a good question here, because you hit at three of the possible warts, three of the possible things that people would campaign against him. But let me sort of go through sort of say, why is he probably doing so well? Probably, A, because we're probably more of a Democratic state than we're a Republican state overall. I mean, the best data that I would look at says that we're probably about 38-39% Democrat, about 33% Republican, you know, give or take a couple of points. And so I think that's going for him. I think the fact of the matter is also that the economy is doing relatively well in the state, and that I think for most people, the economy is always the overriding issue more than anything else. Are people relatively happy with their jobs? Do they have work? And so I think those seem to outweigh a lot of whatever the warts are out there. But there's no question about it that for any Republican challenging them, I think top of the list is going to be those things that you mentioned there. It's going to be the Viking Stadium, although awful lot of Vikings fans out there.
Absolutely.
Awful lot there. And in terms of same-sex marriage, even some of the Republican challengers have said that's over. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people have spoken on this issue. It's over. It's time to move on. And although that might be an issue within the Republican primaries, and then just other things out there in terms of the rollout, clearly a wart, clearly a problem. And I think the Republicans will have to figure out a way of trying to use that as an issue against the governor. But at this point, there doesn't seem to be any clear issue, especially after these first few days of the session, because I think one of the other things Republicans were going to use against him was the fact that last year they had increased taxes on a variety of different areas, income taxes on millionaires, and several business taxes. Well, for the most part, there's not too many millionaires in the state, and most people supported raising taxes on millionaires.
Right, they still do, according to...
Right. And most of those business taxes look like they're going to be repealed this session.
Right.
And therefore, one of the biggest criticisms that the Republicans have on taxes is going to be harder to use again come this November.
Right. And we already see Governor Dayton. We have an estimated $1.2 billion surplus.
Right.
And he has upped the ante on his proposed tax cut package from about $500 million to now $610 million.
Correct. Right?
So that's a sweetener for an election year, too, isn't it?
It is. It's always nice to be a politician, to be Santa Claus during election time to give money back. Now, and tax cuts. And so that's always going to be a good thing to do. Now, I want to do a note of caution.
Okay.
I may be one of the few naysayers in the state on this in terms of saying that I'm not necessarily... Actually, Tom Bach is the other naysayer, maybe.
He is the Democratic leader in the Senate. Is
right, okay. Right, correct. Right. And I say that because I lean towards a direction of saying that at that $1.2 billion, we ought to be saving most of it.
Rainy day, put it away.
Rainy day fund. Okay. Tom Bach, who's in the Senate, and by the way, he's not up for re-election, nor is the Senate. They're more interested in saying, let's put a little bit more into our rainy day fund, still maybe some tax cuts, whereas both the governor who's up for election and for the House of Representatives all up for election, they would like to do more tax cuts and give it away. And the reasoning I give here is a couple of them, is that the last time we really had anything that looked like a surplus was back in 2002. It's been 12
wow.
years. And this is our first real surplus, if in fact it exists. And I'll come back to that in a second here.
Okay.
If in fact it exists. And we would be better off sort of probably saving most of that money simply because we need to have a cushion. And we don't have much in our rainy day fund. And we get a lot of money, for example, from the federal government, an incredible amount of money from the federal government to run a lot of our programs. And as we saw last fall, if the government shuts down, the feds shut down, or let's say they do some pretty significant cuts, we may be caught high and dry in terms of our reserves. And so, A, I think we ought to save a little bit more. But the second is that it's not clear at this point if we really have a surplus or is the surplus, or is our deficit being masked over by just sort of this short-term blip in the upturn in the economy? Yeah. And so I think from a prudential point of view, but I'm not a politician, I'm not elected, and this is what the legislature has to do at this point, is decide what they want to do with that surplus.
Right. Well, Dayton proposes, among other things, he wants to offer tax relief among married couples to eliminate the so-called marriage penalty. That would bring it in line, I think, with some federal laws. Also, he wants lower-income working families, tax relief for them, for college students, daycare users, and small employers. That's a pretty sweet deal sounding, isn't it, for a lot of people?
It is. I mean, for example, my college students love to hear that. Yeah. They would love to be able to have a little bit of break on that. And I think within there, there's some very good proposals. For example, the proposal for the state to assume more responsibility for paying for school lunches for working families, you know, for the children. An incredibly good idea, especially after we heard those stories a few weeks ago about, well, out in Utah, taking lunches away from kids and stuff like that. And we know that that problem potentially exists in Minnesota. So that's probably not a bad proposal. But we're, and so things like that are good. But I was talking to my students the other day, and if my students can be any kind of sort of a barometer.
I always like to ask you what's on their mind.
Okay, yeah, and we talked about this actually yesterday. We talked about it in one of my classes yesterday. What would you do with the $1.2 billion? And a lot of them said save it, but a lot of them said, if we're going to do something with it, let's do something that really makes a difference in the state of Minnesota. You know, and they said that they're not a big fan of sort of doing the old Jesse checks, you know, back when Jesse Ventura was in office, you know, send back some checks. Yeah. But they're saying, is there something that we can do that really makes a difference? And one of my students said, let's do something totally unsexy. And I said, what's that? And she said, let's put more money into roads and highways.
Wow.
And another one said, and this is after she drove on all the potholes in the streets, but another one who's from greater Minnesota pointed out, something that Dayton had pointed out that I think is what, outside of the Twin Cities, it's something like only, what, 38% of the state has access to high-speed internet. And maybe doing something in terms of bringing high-speed internet access to the rest of the state. Mm-hmm. And so I thought these were pretty sophisticated ideas from my students, and I really compliment them on that. And so I would sort of say that that may be something that we should think about, too, is in terms of what can we do with that money that really makes a difference in the state of Minnesota.
Young minds can have a clearer vision than the older minds sometimes. Interesting indeed.
I think so.
Talking about Dayton a lot, well, what about the Republican side of the ledger? Who are they putting up, or who are they likely to put up against Mark Dayton in the race for the governor's office? Marty Seifert, a former legislator, is already, you know, in the race, I think.
Marty's in it, and I think it's a really interesting decision because Marty had run for governor 4 years ago, lost the nomination at the convention to Tom Emmer, left the legislature, and kind of sort of thought he was sort of riding off into the sunset. And because the other candidates who had sort of entered the race in terms of making, you know, making some early entries into the governor's race didn't seem to catch any fire, Marty declared around, I think, what, last November, I think.
It's been some months ago.
But not that long ago. But anyhow, he moved pretty quickly, has done fairly well fundraising, and at the caucuses last February, about a month ago, Marty Seifert came up there either first or second in terms of the sort of, you know, the beauty pageant aspect of the gubernatorial preference polls. And so I would say that he probably is the front runner and may very well be the strongest candidate to put up against Mark Dayton in terms of the fact that he comes from what I call the more moderate wing of the party. And also, I would say, he also has good legislative experience. I mean, he's been in the legislature for many years. And I happen to know him also. And he's just a decent person.
Yeah, he is. I do know him, too.
Yeah.
He's well-liked on the other side of the aisle.
Yeah, he's very well-respected.
He's respected.
Right, and so if he were to get elected governor, I think he would have a good working relationship with the Democrats that I think is clearly important, because we sometimes forget that even though it might sound great in the news for somebody to run for office to say, take no prisoners, and I'm going to beat back the opposition, when push comes to shove, the skills that you really need are how to negotiate and cooperate.
Well, Marty Seifert could get the party endorsement. They'll have the GOP, like the DFL, they will have their endorsing convention coming along. I think it's on the same day, same weekend. And let's just say, for the sake of argument here, that Marty got the endorsement. A lot of Republicans out there are saying, to heck with the endorsement. We're not going to do that anymore. Let's all go to the primary and see who flies there.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty likely to happen at this point, is that the increasingly, I think, people are arguing, especially within the Republican Party, that for the last few years, the endorsement hasn't really produced winners at this point. And therefore, what we really need to do is to move towards challenging that person. Right. And I think the best example of that, take us back 20 years ago, over 20 years ago, Arnie Carlson never won the endorsements at the convention, but of course then wins at in the, actually, in fact, if I remember correctly, his first time running, he didn't even win the primary, if I remember correctly.
There was a mess up. Guy named John Grunseth.
That's right, that's right, that's right. But the point is that most of us would now say that Arnie Carlson may very well have been one of our better governors in the last 40 or 50 years. Yep. But he's the kind of person who could not win within the party, but has broad appeal among sort of, the larger voters at primaries and among the general electorate. And so there may be other Republicans thinking about the idea that, gosh, I can't win at the convention. Mm-hmm. I can't mobilize the delegates through the caucuses. But instead, I have a much better shot going at the primary and being a broader appeal.
Seifert, what do you think? Is he conservative enough for Republicans in the state right now? What do you think?
That's a tough question
at this point, because
the party has, I think, moved even further to the right than it was 4 years ago when Tom Emmer was the nominee. And I think now that... Well, right now, I would say if Tim Pawlenty were trying to get the nomination for governor today, he wouldn't get it. And if Norm Coleman was trying to run for the U.S. Senate to challenge Al Franken again, he wouldn't get the nomination either. And so the party has moved pretty significantly to the right. Remember back in the presidential primaries or caucuses a couple years ago, Mitt Romney didn't win. It actually went to the Ron Paul people instead. And so I would say the Republican Party is, again, perhaps further to the right than Marty Seifert is.
Well, we're going to get to some of the hot button issues here: medical marijuana, raising the the minimum wage, all kinds of things.
Yes,
some really hot issues there. But first, before we take a break here, David, the Minnesota House, unlike the Minnesota Senate, the House is up for election this year.
All 134
are
up.
And of course, it's controlled by the DFL as the Senate is. What are the chances of Republicans taking the Minnesota House?
It's hard because at best there's no more than about 10 or 12 swing seats. Although I've talked to some people who say there's no more than about 8. And so it's going to be hard to pull it off.
All right, okay. We're going to be talking about Congress later, too.
Right.
There might be another story there with the Senate, the U.S. Senate, to see if the Republicans have a shot at that. I think they do. We'll be back with David Schultz, professor at Hamline University, the all-around political and government smart guy. And he is. We'll be right back. To really experience a book, meet the author. I'm Stan Turner for Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Every month, Valley Bookseller's calendar is loaded with events featuring both local and national authors. Visit valleybookseller.com and click the events calendar for a complete list. Choose from monthly events like the Totally Criminal Cocktail Hour or special presentations with authors on tour. Meet your favorite author at Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater.
At Jaime's Haberdashery, men never sacrifice fashion for weather. So no matter how cold it gets, you can still spot a Jaime's man by his impeccable taste and the confidence that only comes from a hot lather shave. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Create a look that's uniquely yours with tailored suits, overcoats, hats, and accessories that make winter blush and at prices that won't melt your wallet. Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul, online at Jaime's.com.
Here's Dr. Tricia Carlson from Stillwater Family Dental. Why is your dental experience so important?
My dental experience has been really critical in shaping me as a dentist. I have worked really hard to learn a lot more about training, especially children. I love working with kids. It's important that kids come in and have a positive experience so that they build long-term relationships with their dentist and their hygienist. They want to come back. They build value into taking care of their teeth for a lifetime.
Stillwater Family Dental. Dentistry for the whole family.
At Golden 61 in Maplewood, we could tell you about our friendly, knowledgeable staff. We could go on and on about our low prices. And although it's true, it doesn't grab you, does it? But this will. The food. Homemade, that's made from scratch. Delicious meals for you and your family that weren't passed to you from a window. Meals that weren't prepared before you got there. And a Sunday brunch that's going to knock your shoes and your socks off. Family meals that will make you feel like family. Golden 61 in Maplewood. Check us out at golden61.com.
We are back here. We are dishing on the body politic and government here this election year, and both in the state of Minnesota and nationally. Much to talk about, and we're so pleased and grateful to have David Schultz, professor of government and law and politics at Hamline University in St. Paul with us. David's a frequent visitor here, and he does enlighten us. It's nice to have light thrown in some of these shadowy areas. Nothing is for sure at this point. This is a moving target, isn't it, David? Trying to forecast what's going on. But we do know there are some red hot issues before the Minnesota legislature right now.
Right.
And one of them is raising the minimum wage. Now, Minnesota has one of the lowest state minimum wages in the country.
Right.
There's been a push for a long time to, especially by the DFL, of course, is to raise that. And some people even talking about, what is it, $6.15 now an hour?
It's six something at state level.
And the federal seven. Yes.
Seven a quarter, I think.
And they're proposed, some in the Minnesota legislature are proposing raising it to $9.50.
Right.
And people are saying, no, 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 that'll cause layoffs. Business is already showing its ranks at the Capitol saying, don't do it. You're going to force us to cut jobs. This is going to have the exact opposite effect of what you so-called do-gooders are trying to do. What do you think? The Democrats are not even together on this. The House and the Senate Democrats at the Minnesota Capitol are warring between each other.
They're warring. They were warring last year because, remember, this was on the agenda last year also, and the Democrats couldn't reach agreement on it. This is one of the issues that they punted. They really want to do something this year.
Yeah.
But again, as we were talking at the break, I think the overriding theme for the Democrats during this legislative session is get out of Dodge really quickly. And what I mean by that, they have certain things they want to get done. They want to deal with that, but that surplus. They want to do the bonding bill. And after that, anything else they can get to, great. But if it's going to generate any controversy, no, they want to leave. And so on the minimum wage one, they would love to be able to do that because it's something important to their political base and something important to their political philosophy in terms of wanting to raise the minimum wage. But there's a huge debate regarding how to actually do this. Do they want to go all the way up to 9 1/4, 10 and a quarter? Do they want to do it in stages? Do they want to index it for inflation?
Mm-hmm.
How they want to do it? And there doesn't seem to be yet an agreement regarding the Democrats on this issue. And again, what if their goal is to both appease their base and to minimize how much they're going to annoy, let us say, the Chamber of Commerce or the Republicans. It's not sure what that sort of almost that Goldilocks, what's the just right amount to do at this point.
There is a national survey, and surveys, we have shelves full of surveys, but this one is out and pretends to be credible. It's a national survey that shows where minimum wages have been raised in states around the country. It has not cost jobs.
That's right, exactly. That the best evidence really is at this point that raising the minimum wage doesn't lose jobs. What it winds up doing is putting more people, more money into many people's pockets. They spend more, and therefore whatever jobs you might have lost as a result of the increase in minimum wage is made up by more demand in the economy. And again, it's sort of an old sort of, you know, I'll call it an old political scientist tale.
Okay.
Old economist tale. Old economist tale that raising the minimum wage is a deterrent to economic growth. The reality is it's not true.
Okay. Folks, we're not advocating one way or the other here. We're just talking about surveys that are out there, and David will be the first to say survey schmurvey. Sometimes they're not worth much. Sometimes they are. It just depends. It just depends on the credibility.
But the other thing I was going to say about the minimum wage, which is interesting about that issue too, is that if you do surveys across the country, and again, take surveys for whatever they're worth, this is a great issue for Democrats because I think even among Republicans, so people who identify themselves as Republicans, not elected officials, but regular people identify as Republicans, about 60 to 65% of the American public supports a raise in the minimum wage. I don't know what the number is in Minnesota, but I think it's also over a majority at this point. I think there's a Star Tribune poll on that. And so it's a very popular issue, and it's a great issue to raise during the session also because what will happen is it could potentially force Republicans to vote against a minimum wage, and therefore you could use that what's called a wedge issue against the Republicans, you know, come this year. So it cuts two ways. Minimum wage could be politically very good for the Democrats in a lot of ways, but it also could be very dangerous for them. And so, again, they're threading that needle, trying to figure out, again, as I say, the Goldilocks one, not too much, not too little, what's just right.
And get out of Dodge.
Right. And that also describes a couple of the other issues, too.
Okay.
I think one of the most divisive issues this session is the anti-bullying legislation.
Anti-bullying.
Right.
Okay.
And this was brought up last year.
You would think that'd be a no-brainer, but there are some catches and hooks in there, aren't there?
Right. There's concerns across the board regarding this. The anti-bullying legislation is a flashpoint on social issues for some of the social conservatives because for them it's all about the issue of gay rights, gay marriage. It's about That's one aspect. For some others, it's all about what they call what the nanny state. You know, it's all about are we basically passing too many laws that tell people what they have to do, what schools, what the government has to do about bullying, that should be something handled by parents. And then there are some who say that this is an issue that's all about unfunded mandates, you know, to school districts. Mm-hmm. Flip side, it's people who are arguing that saying that anti-bullying legislation is exactly what it says, is that we should have laws in place that require school districts to take stronger action to prevent kids from being bullied. Mm-hmm. And so this is a very contentious issue, not sure where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. And then there's a couple of others I'll throw out here.
All right.
The legislature is now in the process of debating medical marijuana. Mm-hmm. And this is one which is a huge flashpoint in lots of ways, because there are lots of people who do support medical marijuana, not just young people, but across all ages. Mm-hmm. But the biggest rub right now is law enforcement in the state does not support a medical marijuana law. And until something's worked without proper safeguards at this point. And I would say that even among the public health community, there are mixed thoughts on this. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an issue that is something that I'm not sure if the legislature is actually going to pass something.
This is an especially tough one because this debate, the medical marijuana debate, pits law enforcement, as you said, against patients and families that are seeking the drug marijuana to treat a host of debilitating conditions. We heard some testimony the other day. Governor Dayton has said he will not sign a bill that law enforcement opposes, so he will not do it. So Paul Thiessen, the Speaker of the House, that's a big deal, a position in the state of Minnesota, arguably the second most powerful. So Thiessen is saying he's not thinking right now to face is a tough fight for sure in the legislature. He's not sure Minnesota will become the 21st state to legalize medical marijuana in this country. So a lot of wrangling, a lot of log rolling, a lot of compromising needs to be done if this thing's going to fly.
Yes.
We just don't know where it's going to go. I want to ask you about another one. Tomorrow, today being Saturday, tomorrow would be Sunday, and there'll be people in Minnesota going across the bridge here to Wisconsin or going down to Iowa if they're a border or to both Dakotas to buy liquor. Buy it off sale at liquor stores. Can't do that in this state on Sunday. And again, Roger Reinert, among others, Roger's up in Duluth, and he's been pushing a Sunday liquor bill for session after session, many, many years. There's some feeling that maybe it might gather some momentum this year, David. What do you think?
It's a possibility, but this is a bill that has an interesting coalition behind it, that you have consumers who really want the bill, who really want this, with the opportunity of being able to do Sunday liquor purchases. On the other hand, you have the Minnesota hospitality industry, and you also have a lot of what I would call sort of the ma-and-pa liquor stores who are against it for fear that if this passes, it now means they have to be open on Sunday, and therefore they're going to force them to be open 7 days a week. Second, they're not convinced that they're going to get any more sales, that instead of having 7 days or 6 days of sales. Let me rephrase. I got to get this right. What they're worried about is that the current 6 days of sales will get spread over 7 days, and not that we'll get additional sales as a result of being open on a seventh day. Mm. And so they're not sure they're going to make any more money. So you have pitted at this point consumers who want it against the hospitality industry, against some of the ma-and-pa liquor stores. This is also not a clear one that it's going to pass, because the coalition that needs to pass it isn't there.
Well, how's it working in other states? All of our border states here have it. Are the little ma-and-pa shops going down the drain?
They're not going down the drain at this point. Okay. But again, also at this point, it's easier to... they've had it in place. Yeah. The problem here is you've got to change vested interests. You've got to change expectations. And for a lot of people in businesses, when you start to change sort of business in terms of rules, then I think people get nervous. Here's where I think it's going to happen. Okay. If I had to put my crystal ball on I think what the possible compromise, although it may not go anywhere, possible compromise is to basically say, it's local option for different cities in Minnesota regarding whether or not they're going to let Sunday liquor sales. And that would just basically become an attachment to a local liquor license in terms of that. Now, is that a viable option? I don't know. But it's a compromise. It's a possibility. Because, again, there may very well be communities in the state of Minnesota that don't want to have local liquor sales. And that's the people's choice. They get to make that call.
One would guess Duluth and places like that, border communities, would jump on it. So give these towns and cities the option of voting for it. Okay.
Right.
These are old blue laws, so-called, aren't they?
These are old blue laws.
Some kind of morality laws. I mean, talking... a century or so ago.
Oh, you are. I mean, there's another one out there that people forget about. We still can't buy a car on Sunday.
Exactly. That's my next question.
That's right. We still have that one there. And
why can't we buy a car on Sunday?
It's still one of the old blue laws, you know. And the blue laws had their origins in sort of the idea.
But what's the rationale behind it?
The old rationale was it was the Sabbath. The rationale is that a lot of the dealerships like it. Why? Because they're all closed on Sunday, and they don't have to then be open on Sunday. From a consumer, we'd probably love to be able to go out and buy a car on Sunday.
Ever gone by a car lot on a Sunday, Kyle? People are out there kicking tires. The lots are full of people looking.
That's right.
I've never paid it. I never even knew that.
Yeah.
My students thinks it's absolutely absurd that you can't go buy a car on Sunday. And again, I think of another possible compromise if they were going to move on it. Although there's no movement on it this year.
Right.
When I was teaching in the state of Texas, car dealerships had to close one day a week. They could pick any day of the week they wanted. So that's a possibility too. But again, I'm not seeing anybody move on the Sunday car sales. But I suspect if we were to eliminate the ban on Sunday liquor sales, that's got to be next in terms of what would happen.
Okay. stay tuned.
Right. And then that way, if we do that, then you could actually go into your new car, buy a new car, and then go to the liquor store and buy your beer.
All in one fell swoop. What a deal.
That's right.
That's progress. We love it.
That's right.
Here's something. Let's talk about this. So this is a strange term. Unsession. Unsession. That's something Governor Dayton is pushing, among others. And basically what that means is purging our state law books of goofy, outdated, nonsensical laws right now.
Yeah.
And Baird Helgeson of the Star Tribune had an interesting lead story on this lead line the other day. He said, in Minnesota, it is a crime to, get this now, it's a crime, and this is true, crime to sell fruit in a container that is the wrong size. Statutes are still on the books that govern gas lamps with three inverted mantles. You can't have those. It's against the law. And how about this? The Minnesota Agriculture Commissioner, by law, must personally capture any wild boars, B-O-A-R-S, spotted in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Kyle, if you were the state agriculture commissioner and I saw a wild boar running around in St. Paul, I would send you personally out there to capture that.
I think I kind of want to just release a couple just to see what they would do.
David, this is crazy stuff, but it's the law, isn't it? Huh?
It is the law. Every state has these really crazy laws. I remember growing up, I think it was in my hometown, I think it was something like illegal to walk your elephant, you know, on the sidewalk or something like that. And you wonder where these laws come from, you know. And on one level, you want to purge those kind of laws. But on the other hand, you have to sort of ask yourself also how much effort you want to put into an accession in terms of really doing this stuff. Now, I think it's worth getting rid of those at some point, but how much, again, legislative time and effort do we want to spend on that? I think when Dayton proposed an unsession in terms of getting rid of unnecessary laws, a lot of it was about legislative streamlining, getting rid of rules that really, really matter in terms of getting rid of things. Again, I don't think too many of us are going to expect, I can't remember who the ag commissioner is in the state now, I don't expect too many of us to see him or her, whoever it is, going out there
corralling
wild boars or something like that.
We've all known boars, haven't we, David?
That's right.
One form or another in St. Paul and Minneapolis.
That's right.
All right, well, we won't pursue that.
That's right.
You mentioned bonding. That's a term not well understood by a lot of people. Bonding. People's eyes glaze over. There's a bonding bill before the legislature. In real simple English, what does it mean?
Okay, let's just think about it. We have two budgets in the state of Minnesota. We have our regular budget, which is the operating budget, which is basically running the government, funding lots of our programs. And then we have a bonding bill. And what the bonding bill does is it pays for, you know, road construction, building new schools, convention centers. It is borrowing money to build what we call capital projects. And those are some incredibly important projects across the state because they mean real jobs. I mean, they're real significant things. And so for anybody who looks at local schools, for example, money for a new school, as I said before, highways, roads, in some sense, very unsexy things.
Mm-hmm,
water, and always water plants, sewer plants, pipes, things like that. But those are the grist of a lot of things that just hold our state together. And we're talking about a number of around, I think you're hearing estimates, of around $800 million in terms of a variety of projects across the state.
Public works projects.
That's another way of describing it, too.
Yep,
sure.
Okay. All right. So, controversial, I suppose. you do get debates. I've covered them. Where St. Cloud, you should not have the ability to upgrade your convention center because in Rochester, we don't have that same kind of money available. And it gets to be very parochial.
It does. But what's interesting in this session is the Republicans and Democrats seem to have roughly agreed, along with the governor, around that $800 million amount.
Okay.
Give or take probably $100 million. And so we're probably not doing too much sort of fighting over the number. It's going to be the exact projects that are out there.
David, we're going to take a break here, but before we do, I've got to ask you another tax-related question. Now, Dayton and others have pitched the NFL to bring the Super Bowl,
right,
to Minnesota about 2018, I think. That's the targeted date, 2018. Of course, the new stadium would be up and running by then. The idea is to forego Minnesota collecting certain sales taxes for tickets to the Super Bowl and related events, whatever the heck that means.
Yeah.
That would be a lot of revenue. That's what the NFL demands if they're going to give you the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And the legislature, they're going to debate this?
They're going to debate it. They're going to probably give them another Christmas present.
Oh, Happy New Year and beyond. We'll be back with David Schultz right after this. At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
At Jaime's Haberdashery, men never sacrifice fashion for weather. So no matter how cold it gets, you can still spot a Jaime's man by his impeccable taste and the confidence that only comes from a hot lather shave. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Create a look that's uniquely yours with tailored suits, overcoats, hats, and accessories that make winter blush and at prices that won't melt your wallet. Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul, online at Jaime's.com.
I'm John Lyons from Landmark Tours, and it's vacation planning time. Join Landmark Tours on one of our inclusive air motor coach vacations. Trips include Hawaii, California coast with Yosemite, Canadian capitals, Canadian Rockies, and the trains of Colorado. These and other tours can be found at landmark-tours.com or call us for a catalog, 651-490-5408. Landmark Tours. Upgrade your travel experience today.
The Gershwin's Porgy and Bess is hitting the road with award-winning members of the Broadway cast in this stunning show. And Stan Turner wants to send you there. Starting on Monday, March 10th and ending Friday the 21st, KLBB will be giving away 5 pairs of tickets to see this award-winning musical live at the Ordway on March 25th and 26th. Don't miss your chance to see what Time Magazine exclaims as a don't-miss theater event, the number one Broadway musical of the year. So tune in to KLBB noon to 2. It's good to be in the club.
Here we are. The time is flying, as it always does when Professor David Schultz is with us. We're chewing on all kinds of issues here that relate directly to you. Yes, the Minnesota legislature is in session. The Congress is in session. What those ladies and gentlemen do impacts us all.
Yes.
We need to sit here and pick David's mind. He can give us some direction. Nobody pretends to know exactly what's going to happen, but David has a length and breadth of experience on these things, has written about them. We'll talk about that, too. Before we move to Congress, David Schultz, there is a proposal for something called judicial retention elections. Boy, is that a mouthful. That'll make people's eyes
glaze. That's right, they'll glaze.
This would change the way we elect and re-elect judges in the state of Minnesota. Not federal judges, but state judges.
Correct.
District judges. And in essence, what is the proposal? What would it do that we don't have now?
Well, we have to talk about what the problem is, potentially.
Okay.
The problem stems from a couple of federal, one of them a Supreme Court case about a decade ago, that basically said that judges in the state of Minnesota and across the country are relatively freed up to state their positions on issues coming before the court, that they basically can fundraise, they can solicit, they can do anything like any other person running for office. And what the fear is that our judicial elections would turn into what we see in some other states, Texas, Wisconsin, across the border, where they're high-stakes, political, very acrimonious, you know, very contentious elections. And so the concern is that we want to find a way to try to prevent that nightmare from happening, because what they want to prevent is a situation where we basically turn our judicial elections and our judicial system in Minnesota, which is actually a very, very good system that we have, which is supposed to be an elected system, and move it from sort of a contested election system to a retention system. And what that would mean, for those of you who ever remember this from physics, this is basically what's called the Missouri plan. And what it would be is that judges would be initially appointed based upon merit.
Right.
They would serve for about a year in office, and then they would then face a retention election where the voters would be asked, should Judge Smith or, you know, Judge, you know, whoever
but
it is.
But they'd be reviewed by a nonpartisan commission first, and that would be made public.
So, exactly, the review.
David, if you were a judge and you weren't doing a good job, the review board or whatever it is would say, Schultz is not doing so well.
That's right, and that recommendation
that
wouldn't
throw you out, but the voters would decide.
They would know about that, right? And so this is going to require a constitutional amendment to change the way we select judges. Now, I should say one other thing. Even though we're supposed to have an elected judicial system, approximately 90% of the judges who serve in the state of Minnesota get there initially by gubernatorial appointment, because what winds up happening is that most people who are judged so hate the idea of running for office that they resign a few months before their term ends, governor replaces them, and puts somebody else in place. And so what this would do is to sort of take what I think is kind of a farce right now that says we're an elected judiciary, but we really appoint most of them, and turn it into really what it's become now is more or less an appointed merit system with a retention election. Now, this sounds all well and good. However, this is becoming a flashpoint for the Tea Party that does not support the transition from this current elected system to a judicial retention system. And this would be something that, it's not clear it's going to get through the legislature, because, again, this is a constitutional amendment, has to go to the voters, and requires majority vote. Now, the Democrats could carry it on simple majority vote, but it's not clear at this point that it has the votes among the Democrats, and that if it goes to the voters, it's not clear that with the Republican Tea Party presence, especially in the state, that it would get the sufficient votes it would need to be able to pass.
All right. David Schultz, let's move on.
Actually, I was going to talk about one other thing, though.
Yes, sir. Please do, Professor.
One of the other proposals that's being talked about there, I should mention this, is actually a proposal to change how we amend the Constitution. Because what all it takes right now is a majority vote of the legislature. The governor doesn't have to sign off on it. Then it goes to the voters, and then an absolute majority of the voters in that election have to vote in favor of it. One of the proposals that seems to be getting some bipartisan support is the idea of saying that it shouldn't be a simple majority of the legislature that sends a constitutional amendment to the voters, but some kind of qualified majority. Now, is that 60%? Is it two-thirds? Is it three-quarters? I don't know. But there seems to be some support for the idea of saying that we ought to make it harder to amend the state constitution.
Okay.
And there's a good debate backwards and forwards on that.
Okay. David, let's jump to the national scene right now.
Sure.
A lot of Democrats in the House and Senate up for re-election or trying to get elected have been worried that they might get bitten in the hindquarters by so-called Obamacare.
Right.
There's been so much trouble with the rollout and all the rest. Lo and behold, this week, our president, Barack Obama, said that health plans that currently are held by millions of Americans can be kept into
right.
the year 2017. That pushes that unpopular aspect of Obama's initiative past the fall election.
And so, past the next presidential election.
A collective sigh of relief from Democrats, especially.
Yes,
yes
you can, because he's pushed this. He's also pushed some of the mandates for businesses past the next election, too. And again, there's no question about the fact that the federal rollout has been a botch.
Yep.
There's no
yep.
question
yep.
about it.
Yep.
Although it does seem to be solving some of its problems and more people enrolling, but it's clearly, again, another one of these issues that's highly contentious, not good for the Democrats, and it's generally not a good election for the president's party in that last midterm election of a second term. So historically, this is not a good election for presidents anyhow. It's not looking like a great Democratic year. Public opinion polls are suggesting, again, for whatever they can be believed, that while the public generally likes where the Democrats stand more on the issues, the Republicans have an advantage in terms of generic polls, and they also have an advantage in the House of Representatives. We'll start there first.
Well, they already control that.
They already control it. All right. And there's 435 people in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. And of those, the best estimates are that less than 50 of those seats are truly contestable in the country. And so the Democrats would have to have an extraordinary year to be able to take back control of the House. And so best guess is that Republicans hold the House of Representatives. Where everything is up for stake is in terms of the battle for the U.S. Senate. Because right now, the Senate has a five-vote majority. Actually, I should say the Democrats have a 55-45, I think it is, by the time you count the independent candidates like Bernie Sanders, a 55-45. Mm-hmm. However, the Democrats are defending, I believe, 23 seats, and the Republicans are defending 10 seats. There are several Democrats who are retiring from the Senate in states that were won by Mitt Romney. The Republicans have a better than even chance of taking control of the U.S. Senate this year.
A better than even chance,
yes,
of a GOP Senate. Interesting, in Kentucky, that might not hold true for Mitch McConnell.
That's right.
He's an incumbent Republican senator from Kentucky. He's got some stiff opposition, doesn't he?
He has stiff opposition. The Tea Party people believe he's not conservative enough, and so a very conservative Tea Party candidate is challenging him. And if that Tea Party person were to win, pushing the party further to the right, you would have the state attorney general, who's a Democrat, quite popular running. And Kentucky is fascinating because Kentucky is a state that is otherwise a reliably Republican state. However, Obamacare is exceedingly popular in Kentucky, that they have embraced that state, where they've enrolled, I can't remember what the exact number is, but I think they've enrolled about 250,000 people in that state. And Kentucky is one of the few success stories in terms of pretty strong support for Obamacare. So this is not the kind of state that if you're a Tea Party candidate that you can run that successfully against Obamacare, because it's insuring a lot of people. So that's one possible state the Democrats can pick up. The other state is Georgia, where Saxby Chambliss, if I remember correctly, Saxby Chambliss is running for re-election, and the Democrats are putting up as a possible candidate the daughter of Sam Nunn.
Oh, boy.
Incredibly popular Democrat who held that seat for, I must think, probably at least a quarter century, if not longer. And Sam Nunn's daughter, very popular, playing off of her father's name, has, I think, again, a decent chance, perhaps, of being able to win that seat. And so if the Democrats were to pick up either Georgia or Kentucky, then the chances of the Republicans being able to take control of the Senate becomes almost impossible. It's still better than even for Republicans, but no foregone conclusion.
Okay, well, that's the answer I was looking for.
Right.
We really can't tell, but there are signs that the Republicans could grab it. However, as you say, in a couple of key states,
right,
it could go out the
other way. I always remind people, if I could predict the future, my stock portfolio would be a lot better, and I'd be playing the ponies at Canterbury.
And I'd piggyback on that with you, and we'd
good.
Go out and hunt wild boar in the St.
Paul. That's right. That's right.
David, anything else on the national scene we should talk about? We can go to the international scene. You have taught in Kiev, haven't you?
I have taught in Kiev, and I've been to Kiev once, and I've taught there in the Ukraine, and I've also taught in Moscow six times.
Let me ask you why, and this is just rhetorical here, why do we need to care about what's going on in Ukraine? Apart from, obviously, the humanitarian concerns, we don't want people to get hurt and all the rest, but why should we be injecting ourselves, the U.S., in that?
The images of 1938 and its Munich and its Germany, where we basically conceded to Hitler and said, okay, you can have part of Czechoslovakia to buy peace, and it didn't buy peace.
Did we do that, or did Britain do
Britain
that?
Britain did, I should say.
Not
Britain,
us.
Yeah. Not that. There's a famous picture of Neville Chamberlain waving a piece of paper, which I can't do here, saying, I have assurances from Herr Hitler, we now have peace in our time. And it didn't I think it's peace in our time or last name. I think it's peace in our time.
Peace
I can't remember. Peace in our
time.
And the big issue is, if we let the Russians carve off Crimea, the concern is, especially among the rest of our allies, what else is he going to want next? And again, I've also taught, by the way, I have also taught in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, former parts of Russia, who are very worried. Poland's very worried. A lot of other countries are worried that if we concede on Crimea, what's next?
Mm-hmm.
And that's
the old
concern.
Domino theory.
It's a variation of the domino theory, yeah. But it's also a different, it's not just domino, it's also that image that maybe is no longer valid, I don't know, the image of appeasement of Hitler.
I see. Interesting. What if the other side, what if Russia turned around and said, we don't like what you're doing in Arkansas, you're mistreating people there, and we want to intervene. What would we say?
Well, that's a tough question.
That's
here.
Rhetorical again. That's a devil's. I'm just saying. People have asked me that.
It is a good devil's advocate question, and I think what we have to be thinking about here is a variety of very tough questions, all about international human rights law, about the role of the United States in enforcing international law. I should also say, by the way,
that
there are lots of people who would criticize the United States right now for our use of drones across the world as violations of international sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So. Again, I don't have an easy answer to this question. These are very, very tough questions in terms of trying to sort them out in terms of what we should do. But I would say that at least with Ukraine, mm-hmm. part of the issue is a country that is an emerging democracy, and what do we want to do in terms of supporting mm-hmm. democratic movements across the world?
Under international law, what can we, the U.S., do legally?
We probably can't do a lot at this point.
Isn't that what NATO and the U.N.?
Yeah. Well, the U.N.'s supposed to be able to do something on this. This is a Security Council matter, of which Russia is on the Security Council, of which it gets a veto, which means it'll veto it.
Sure.
In terms of NATO, Ukraine is not a NATO member, and so we don't have a defense treaty with Ukraine in terms of defense. If it were, for example, if Russia were to roll into Poland, that's a different story entirely because we would have our mutual defense treaties. Now, I should say one other thing also about Ukraine and Moscow. Again, I've been getting emails back and forth from people I know at universities over in Moscow and asking them what are their thoughts. And their thoughts are over there that except for the extremists, they said they don't want war either. They don't want war over Ukraine, over Crimea, and they certainly don't want war with the United States. And so we need to understand the fact that their people seem to be where we are, as our people. Mm-hmm. We don't want war.
Okay. David, you have authored, to my mind, one of the most important books to come out in many, many years, called American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. It's a pretty strong indictment. What it says, and you've written here, I'll quote, the American public is woefully ignorant about American politics and government, and the same may be true for many elected representatives when it comes to understanding social and hard science information.
Yes.
Boy, that's a kick in the posterior. This is why we, our elected reps, continue to try the same old failed policies time and again?
And that's exactly what I'm interested in, is the question of how we see certain ideas get recycled just over and over again, and why do they keep pushing ideas that we have, not just social science or scientific evidence, but past experimentation and past efforts to do things. Why do they think that they're going to work this time when they didn't work in the last time? And what my book is all about, and it came out about a year ago, is that gap between what we know and the information that policymakers use when they legislate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to make note, and if I can find it here, and I hope I can, I want to note the passing of a very fine man. I, to my mind, a man in the state of Minnesota here, an elected representative who rose to the level of statesman. We mm-hmm. don't have many of those, it seems, anymore. Rod Searle.
Yes.
Now, you're fairly new to the... I mean, fairly new. Yes. Not, you've been along, but he's been... Rod Searle was a long-time Waseca lawmaker in the state legislature. Sadly passed away. Well, he had a long life, about 92 years old. And in a book he wrote, Searle, a Republican, he became Speaker of the House by an evenly divided House, so the Democrats liked him as much as the Republicans did. In a book he wrote, Rod Searle said of his service as Speaker, out of necessity and challenged by the legislative concerns of the times, raw politics was minimized and a system of balance, cooperation, and mutual respect produced workable solutions to the problems that confronted us back in the 70s.
Yeah.
That almost sounds quaint, doesn't
it? Was quaint, but it was...
It worked,
and he was part of that coalition of Republicans and Democrats who worked together to help produce, and I notice you see Tom Berg's book here.
That's a great book, too.
It's a great book, The Minnesota Miracle. It's an amazing book, and it's a great story about how Minnesota basically came together to change its funding formula for education, its tax system, and really produce the modern Minnesota Minnesota that we have now and move us from the old sort of smokestack era, an old Minnesota to the new Minnesota. And so Searle was part of that great coalition of legislators.
The bottom line was there was cooperation between the Democrats and the Republicans.
Right.
They worked together. They could spat and spar on the floor of the House and Senate, but after the sun went down, they'd get together over a meal and a couple of drinks and write a bill, a good law.
Right. They acted like adults.
They did. David, you said it. There we go. David Schultz, thank you so much.
Anytime.
Friend. This is wonderful. We'll have you back for a checkup here on the body politics down the road a bit, okay?
And sometime on your music show.
You're coming on the weekday show with me one of these days.
Yes.
You're a New Yorker, but you grew up with the great rock era, didn't you?
I did.
So we're going to have you on board, and we'll have fun, okay?
Good.
Thanks, David. Thank you. David Schultz, Professor Hamlin University. We're out of time, I think, aren't we, Kyle? Is that it?
Yeah, just about 20 seconds.
Boy, that's not much. It's time enough for me to say, have a great weekend. Thank you so much for your company. We'll see